People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing.
But the net zero madness is closing down factories, is closing down industry on a scale we couldn't have even believed today.
My administration has taken action to abolish all discriminatory diversity, equity, and inclusion nonsense.
Never mind the planet.
Right. Hello and welcome to Never Mind the Planet. This is our new monthly podcast, which could become a weekly podcast, depending on how this goes. Hopefully it won't end up being our only ever podcast or only ever episode. But yeah, let's see how it goes. And what we're aiming to do is bring together all things sustainability, bring it right back down to earth. So I'm Simon Derrick, sustainability strategist, founder of SBA, and someone who's worked in the food industry for many years, and actually speaking live from Silverstone Race Circuit, would you believe it, here today. Just so happens that I'm here. So if you hear some racing cars in the background, you know why that is. And I'm joined today by Ebenezer and Shay, who's going to introduce themselves. So I'll hand over to Ebenezer.
Thank you, Simon. I'm Dr. Ebenezer Lai, reader in sustainable development law at Aston University. And as you will know, Simon, the occasional translator of acronyms no one has asked for. Together, we'll be navigating the highs, lows, and of course, the downright contradictions of sustainability, law, policy, and business.
Absolutely. So yeah, great that you can join us here today. And you know, hopefully, maybe we'll think of some more acronyms as we go through the series. But let's get this straight. We're not here to preach, but we're here to provoke and hopefully help you to make a bit more sense of a world where climate change is real, but there's a lot of complexity, a lot of arguments and counter arguments, and everyone's talking net zero, but no one necessarily agrees with what it means.
Absolutely, Simon. And of course, each episode will include experts that will be joining us, thought leaders, and sometimes obviously, we'll just be talking to each other to pick apart the week's sustainability stories and what they mean for business, policymakers, and people who, frankly, just want to do the right thing.
Yeah, and also bringing you the headlines and your questions. So we're going to get your questions as we go through these podcasts. So you know, if you've got questions that you want to put in the chat now, please do. You can write to us and we can answer your questions in subsequent episodes, but bringing us those headlines and hopefully giving us your questions, we've got our resident news hawk and question curator, Dr. Shay Omolosu. Shay,
yes,
are you there?
I am there. Hi, everyone. It's great to be here. I'm Dr. Shay Omolosu. I'm associate professor of sustainable business at the University of Northampton. And I'll be bringing the spice, keeping us grounded with a roundup of what's making news in the world of sustainability and business, surfacing your comments and questions, as well as your suggestions. So let's get right into it.
Right. Well, thank you, Shay. And as I think I said, this is all a bit experimental. We've not done a podcast before, so this could go all horribly wrong. So bear with us. And if something doesn't go according to plan, we're just going to roll with it and then hopefully you don't notice. And we're going to dive straight in now and find out what news stories and articles have been caught that have caught Shay's eye over the last few days and weeks. So Shay, what's been going on in the world of sustainability that we should perhaps be talking about today?
Well, I would say a lot of stories. You know, I've been making the rounds, but there are a few standouts which I would mention in the next couple of minutes. So strap in, get yourself a cup of coffee, and let's hear this together. Right. So I'll start by talking about the weather and the climate. Quite topical, isn't it? given that we're seeing very, very hot weather or temperatures in the UK at this time of the year, and we are not even in the middle of July yet. So in the UK, we're experiencing the third heat wave of the year, and BBC has asked the question, is this just a typical summer or clear signs of climate change? Even though heat waves are not new, these patterns, one after the other, are harder to brush away as just summer. Heat records are broken, have been broken for spring this year already. So perhaps it's safe to say that the expression go outside and touch grass should officially be changed to stay inside and drink water. In Texas, on the other hand, we are seeing devastating floods. A climate scientist wrote in Time that flooding has always happened, but climate change is supercharging it, and most places aren't even ready. All over the world, we're seeing temperature changes, and we are ill-equipped to undo this. I'll then move forward to talk about perceptions of net zero. And older people are more skeptical, more than ever. In fact, a survey via AD.net found that over 65 year olds are much likely to support net zero, or they're more likely to oppose net zero policies, while the rate of opposition decreases you move down the age gap. So younger generations are more likely to support net zero policies, while over 65 year olds are more likely to oppose net zero policies. Now, given that the over 65 are the most reliable voters, this could influence how far politicians push climate agendas. In fact, political spins are in motion. The reform leaders been bragging about one of their councils being the first to ditch net zero commitments. This is news via BBC. And in addition to that, Conservative Party leader as well has suggested that she would axe the 2050 commitment to net zero. She has argued that meeting it would be too costly, increasing household costs and risk energy security. So this could be a big political wedge going forward. That's that on perceptions of net zero. We'll look at another topic on the environmental impact of data centers. Again, quite topical, given everything that we know and we are seeing about AI, artificial intelligence today. So Google's emission is rising significantly. So even with the big efforts to green their data centers and buy renewables, Google's total emissions are still going up. This is news via ESG Dive. So it just shows how difficult it is to keep up with AI data center demand. In fact, there has been a lot of news articles about the use of nuclear energy to complement the energy use to complement the energy required to meet up with this demand. Also, data centers are having significant impact on water locally. In fact, BBC did a story not too long ago on a woman in the US who alleged that she can't safely drink her tap water anymore because of contamination linked to a nearby data center. Her house was a safe haven, and she has said that is no more the case. Also, data centers are being built in the driest of places. The Guardian revealed that big tech is putting huge new data centers in some of the world's driest places, sucking up already limited water supplies in this region. So a lot to unpack there, from heat waves on our doorstep to who actually supports net zero, to the hidden cost of keeping our digital lives running. So you guys, where do you want to start?
Well, thank you very much, Shay. Let's just pause there. Lots of big topics, Ebenezer, to talk about. What do you think?
Yep. Thanks, Simon. I think obviously lots of big topics, lots of challenges, clearly, for us to grapple with as a global community. And all quite environmental focused, of course, for our first podcast, which is fine. And a couple of stories on the reality of climate change, which will be good to explore. a bit more in a little while on this podcast, but also interesting to hear about this increasing pushback on net zero, which before we talk about in a moment, I think would be interesting to ask our listeners about. And I guess one of the key questions for anyone listening is, are you finding more and more people expressing concerns about the concept of net zero and even seeing it as something which is no longer, you know, either relevant and therefore in decline? And if so, what do you think the reasons are for it? You know, let us know in the chat or send us an email at nevermindtheplanet@sustainablebusinessalliance.org.uk, and we'll share some of your thoughts either at the end of this podcast if we get them in time, or certainly in the next episode.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ebenezer. Yeah, so as you said, if you are listening, do have questions, or you do have some comments that you want to share, please do put them in the chat or send them to us via email. I'm sure we can sort of set up some other options sooner or later. Maybe we can set up a TikTok account or share via X once we once we can extend to those other platforms. But for now, yeah, we're just going to use the good old fashioned chat facility and email. But let's look at some of those stories. So, two or three stories we're looking at sort of those extreme weather events, the net zero pushback, and then AI and data centers. So let's start with extreme weather events. Lots and lots in the press, obviously not just in the press, but we can experience it, whether if we're in Europe, the European heat wave, in the UK, obviously, lots of high temperatures. Shay mentioned a few stories, one in the BBC and much of the press actually this morning, I think in response to the Met Office, the UK Met Office, saying extreme weather is the UK's new normal, which is interesting. So let's start with that. How far is climate change to blame? Because as soon as we sort of see some of these sort of extreme weather events, extreme flooding, there's this debate in terms of, is it climate change? And there's the other side maybe saying, well, perhaps we are overemphasizing climate change. I could perhaps hear a few people sort of, shouting at us now saying, of course it's climate change. But I think we've got to acknowledge that there are increasingly those who aren't convinced or saying it's not climate change. The climate is always changing and always going to get extreme weather. So, what's the reality here? Ebenezer, what do you think?
Yeah, thanks, Simon. I think it's a very topical question. And I think there are a number of places to start. I mean, first and foremost, like you said, Simon, the Earth's climate has always changed. You can go back billions of years in time, and you'll find that there are ice ages, and then the ice age thaws out, then there's a period of warming on the planet, and that inadvertently leads to another ice age, and then the cycle goes on and on and on. But I think for what we're facing now, yes, the climate is changing, yes, it's warming, but this is different. It's different to any other period in history because there is the human factor. And I think, of course, when it comes to the question of whether our climate is changing, the answer is before our very eyes, because we're seeing weather events and we're seeing different climatic events happening now, which were not happening in the way that they're happening 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, even if you go back 100 years ago. So the evidence, I think, is very stark. The climate is changing, and in many ways has changed already. I do not think that is any much in doubt anymore. Then comes the second question of, well, what is driving this change, and is the rate of change in line with what With the rate of change that we've seen previously in other cycles of warming that the planet has gone through. And I think when you compare over a period of time, you come to the inescapable conclusion, Simon, that human activity, particularly the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere, is accelerating the warming. And the warming of the planet is having these knockoff impacts and effects because obviously our weather is a complicated system, right, of different elements. And turning up the heat within that system means that you're going to get a whole range of different impacts. So obviously higher warming means much hotter summers, less cold winters, extreme rainfall, because you've got that warming and you know, obviously in hurricane prone areas, you know, you've got more extreme hurricanes, etc. So effectively, Simon, what's happening is that all weather patterns that we can think of that are influenced by higher temperatures are going way out of scale in terms of the extremity, whether it's a hurricane that builds because you've got warmer ocean temperatures, or whether it's very heavy rainfall because you've got higher temperatures and more evaporation of water, you know, into the atmosphere, or whether it's very, very dry summers and extremely dry heat, which means that the ground is extremely dry. So even if it rains slightly above moderate levels, because the ground is so dry, it can't soak up the water and you end up with flash flooding. Whichever way you look, clearly, one would argue that our activities, our commercial activities, which have concentrated fossil emissions from fossil fuel sources in the atmosphere, is having a huge impact. And so, yeah, for me, I think, Simon, that the answer is inescapable.
Yeah, and I think... But it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think there's, you know, probably, you know, a consensus of, you know, scientific opinion that would agree with that. But something's going wrong because, you know, there's still this, you know, this increasing group, I might say, that is pushing back on this. That's perhaps saying that. You know, humans, human activities, you know, aren't having as big a influence than what might be assumed. In fact, there was an article in The Guardian in June the 19th, I think, talking about how climate misinformation is turning a crisis into a catastrophe, is the headline. And it talks about quite often with some of these big, you know, climatic events, you know, for instance, the flooding in Spain, you'll see conspiracy theories coming out. And actually staying with Spain, actually, it was the, if you remember, the blackout earlier this year, where there was conspiracy theories about, you know, solar panels. So solar panels being the cause, and actually some of the things that we're doing to counter climate change or reduce emissions are actually, you know, creating problems. You know, likewise, I think there was, I think the article talks about this as well. You know, I mean, it's, I take what you think from what this says, but misinformation about the wildfires in Southern California, saying it was planned by officials in order to destroy child trafficking tunnels. I mean, what? But you know, these are things that people seriously are thinking. And the other, you know, the other example I just wanted to give was from, might get a bit political here, but. I think it was, I don't know if it was this year or might have been towards the end of last year, when we had Nigel Farage coming out and saying that you know, politicians shouldn't worry about man-made carbon dioxide emissions. And he admitted he was not a scientist, but the point he was making was that, well, I can quote, he says, I'm not a scientist. I can't tell you whether CO2 is leading to warming or not, but there are so many other massive factors, downplaying the significance of CO2 and human activity. How do we respond to that? You know, you've just said, you know, there's overwhelming evidence to say that the climate is changing, but how do you respond to those who say that actually CO2 and human activity, you know, isn't a significant cause of that?
Yeah, thanks, Simon. I think it's a tricky one, although a part of me feels like it should not be, because, of course, the evidence is right in front of us, and it's happening all the time. And, of course, it seems now these days, over the last 5 years, certainly, it has been the case that it appears that every year that we go through ends up being a record setter. So this year is already, you know, on track to be the warmest year on record, which was warmer than last year. And last year was warmer than the year before that. And the year before that was warmer than the year before that. So I think the evidence is clear there. Where I think things are going wrong in terms of sort of the pushback and obviously all the conspiracy theories is around, I think, the narrative in terms of how we understand net zero and its importance to addressing carbon emissions. And there is an entire misunderstanding of what net zero is. So, for example, Simon, there are elements of the public. There are people that feel that or who think that net zero means zero emissions. And of course, that's not what it means, right? Net zero refers to the balancing, right? The need for us to balance the amount of greenhouse gases emitted into the atmosphere with an equivalent amount removed, so that the net contributions to atmospheric warming is essentially zero, right? So it's about the net contribution being zero, not that there won't be any emissions in the atmosphere at all, because obviously carbon dioxide is a natural gas. It's not a man-made gas, so it's part of the atmosphere and will remain there even if we didn't have any emissions at all. But there is a huge misunderstanding around this, and a lot of people feel it is about, sort of clamping down on them using a petrol car or a diesel car, and that's not what it's about. It's about us trying to find balance, because the fact of the matter is, if we do not find balance, we're going to be having more and more and more of these extreme weather events, and it's not going to end anytime soon. So I think it's about changing the narrative to help people understand what net zero really means.
Yeah, and I think we're going to get on to what Nigel Farage calls the net zero madness in a moment. And actually, you know, to that story that Shay referred to about the I think it was Shay, the over 65s who are the age group that's most likely to turn against net zero. You know, what could be driving that? You know, what could be the cause of that? And how can we change that? So I think we'll get to that in a moment. But I'm interested in Shay, your view here. It's not necessarily climate change denial, because it's almost sort of progressed onto, okay, yeah, the climate is changing, but it's you know, the degree to what, you know, humans are causing it is what's being disputed. You know, there are some who might say that actually, you know, there's no point sort of, you know, slowing down our economies. There's no point us, you know, causing more hardship. So, you know, just accept that the climate is changing and adapt to a climate changing. Our efforts to lower emissions aren't going to have much impact. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think, there are several reasons as to, I think, why some of this might be happening in terms of the over 65-year-olds. I think one of it is probably not one of the reasons might be down to political parties also pushing certain narratives. You know, for example, Reform UK argue that larger emitters like China and the US should bear more responsibility in the global climate fight. But they're also touting job creation in coal and fracking industries, you know, to improve the economy. So that's where they're coming from in that dimension. But as we know, you know, as the age, you know, reduces, you know, younger people are more inclined, are more likely to support net zero policies and support actions to reduce climate change and its impact. So I think generationally, you know, it might be I wouldn't say the younger generations are they're more inclined to protect the environment. But that is that's looking like the reality at the moment. But I think more investigations need to take place with regards to this. The younger generation would also come along and say, well, it's the older generation that have destroyed the planet with their actions, and they're not taking actions towards it. So there's a gap there that also needs to be addressed, you know, in that way. So those are my views at the moment. But yeah. Of course, the other part of that would be costs, you know, when it comes to cost of addressing climate change and how that could potentially increase household costs, as alleged by, you know, a conservative party leader. So that could also appeal to some certain, you know, to part of the population that, you know, they definitely don't want their household costs to increase. And it's that psychological thing as well. When you disseminate a survey, you know, to assess how people are more inclined to change their behaviors when it comes to sustainability and a sustainable future, you know, many would say, well, we definitely do not want climate change. We don't want the impact of climate change. But then when it comes to what are you going to do to address that, what changes are you willing to make? Are you willing to pay a bit more for certain things? Are you willing to pay a bit, you know, more for certain services? The answer will likely, you know, be either neutral or less likely to do so. Again, so the economic impact also bears some level of consideration here as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that when we look at the views of certain demographics and voter intention, there seems to be more and more voters who are skeptical of net zero, and I just wonder why that might be. And you mentioned a sort of a few things there, Shay, things like behavioral change, and actually maybe a sort of fear of the unknown, because is there a sort of fear in terms of what that this might mean in terms of cost of living? Are people equating to mm-hmm. where we've seen recent, you know, rises in the cost of living to net zero? Is it, you know, where we sort of see you know, renewable energy transition and talk about, you know, policies and investment, you know, is the assumption automatically that my bill's going to go up and therefore, you know, this isn't something I should be supporting? Likewise, things like sort of heat pumps, the cost of switching to heat pumps to warm, and we might also include cool our homes in the future as well, might be something that people are cynical of. The other one worth mentioning is solar, you know, and I think particularly from rural communities, you can see quite often sort of pushback because of the, I guess, concerns over the amount of land that this could take to put all of these solar panels, you know, and is this actually going to give us the energy security which we need, or might it actually put us at greater risk of power cuts like we recently saw in Spain and Portugal? So there's a question there, are we failing to communicate the facts You know, because I think there's a lot, whether it be conspiracy theories, whether it just be just a lack of understanding of, you know, the reality. And Ebenezer, yeah, you talked about net zero, people just not understanding what net zero is. That's part of the problem here. You know, is this actually a communications problem?
Yes, Simon, I think it is a communications problem. And, you know, I think the conversation that we've been having so far itself has highlighted some of the issues, which in my view are myths. So, for example, and we can bust those myths right now. Let's do a bit of myth buster. So, for example, myth number one is that net zero as a policy is contributing to energy bills here in the UK. Actually, it's not. Energy bills are higher here in the UK compared to energy bills in mainland Europe, primarily because in the UK, we rely on fossil fuel sources for our electricity. And so, of course, when the international price of gas or of oil goes up, but mainly gas, because obviously that's the main source of electricity generation for us here in the UK, when the international price of gas goes up, that is hitting everybody's energy bills. Comparatively, when you look across the continent, energy bills are lower because there is a less of a reliance on generation from fossil fuel sources. So net zero as a policy is actually the solution, not the cause of higher energy bills. And that needs to be communicated a lot more. So there is that first myth. Then there is the second myth, which you often hear being discussed, which is in relation to other polluters, mainly China. So politicians on the right in the UK would say, well, why should the UK be going through this costly process to move away from conventional fuels to renewables and to change the way that we the way that we live and the way that we do business in line with our net zero policies in order to bring our emissions down. Look at China. China is not bringing their emissions down. China is emitting and is using coal as it always has. The problem with that argument is that it no longer holds. It did hold a few years ago, but guess what? There's something new that's happening in China, and I'll give you the facts right here. So China has increased significantly over the past sort of 18 months, from 2024 up to where we are in this year. China has increased its renewable energy capacity. So, for example, in 2024 alone, they added over 300 gigawatts of renewable energy, you know, to their grid. That is massive, and they're doing the same thing for in terms of sort of clean energy generation generally, you know, which is rising, and that capacity is growing faster in China than it is anywhere else in the world. In addition to that, as of the end of 2024, what a lot of people don't recognize is that China had about increased its sort of renewable energy capacity by some 25% in that single year. And that increase meant that China now has more renewable energy capacity than its coal fleet currently. And also the increase that they've had in their renewable energy capacity dwarfs the US, which currently has roughly around slightly over 300 gigawatts of renewables, whereas China currently has about 1,800 gigawatts of renewables. So China is outpacing the United States and also Europe when it comes to renewable energy capacity. So the argument that is advanced by politicians to say, well, why should the UK be changing its tune when a big polluter like China is not, that argument is gone. And we have to be able to communicate this to say, look, the world is moving on. The world is rushing for renewables, and the UK will be left behind unless we change course.
Yeah. And actually, of course, you know, thinking about it from the UK perspective, and obviously mindful of the fact that they'll there'll be people listening from other parts of the world as well. But just staying on the UK for a moment, you could certainly argue that, you know, for us to be competitive, we need to be investing in, you know, green technology, into renewables, into, you know, electric vehicles and all of the other, you know, potentially really exciting technologies that can come with the transition, you know, rather than sort of looking at it in terms of this sort of skeptical view, which isn't necessarily going to, you know, propel us into where we need to be to have a sort of secure future. I just want to sort of talk about one aspect or one factor which may be causing, maybe a cause for some of the skepticism, is groups like Extinction Rebellion and other sort of, you know, climate activist groups. You know, are they helping or are they hindering the cause? Because quite often you sort of see negative headlines in the newspapers, you know, where disruption is caused. And of course, you can completely understand why groups like Extinction Rebellion are going to these extremes to raise awareness of what of their cause, particularly, you know, if they don't see others taking seriously what they're saying. But it does actually do more harm than good in terms of, you know, back to that kind of communication, the messaging, getting people to understand and come round to what, you know, what frankly we need to be doing.
Indeed, Simon, I think it's disruptive. And I think that is the main issue that I have with groups like Extinction Rebellion. And of course, one can understand the passion with which they want to have this issue noticed and addressed. One can also understand that clearly they have a sense of urgency, and rightly so, because, you know, climate change is an urgent problem and we need to be doing everything we possibly can to address it. But of course, we have to have the right tactics as we go about that business, and disrupting people's lives and putting people at risk in order to draw their attention to the fact that climate change is an urgent problem does not strike me to be the most appropriate and productive way of doing that. I think that kind of tactic ends up causing so much disruption that we actually lose people rather than drawing them to our cause. And that would be my only criticism of Extinction Rebellion. I think they've just got, you know, they of course they're fighting for the right cause, but they've got the wrong tactics, and they're going about it entirely the wrong way. And in my view, that has flowed into the public mood when it comes to net zero, when it comes to climate change, in some ways. Because, of course, for those whose lives have been disrupted, and there are people who've had their lives severely disrupted and have had lasting impacts on them as a result of some of the protests by groups like Extinction Rebellion, for those people, they are, of course, going to look very skeptically at the push for net zero and other initiatives that we need to do to address climate change. So I think, yeah, it's a big problem when approached that way.
Yeah, and I think you could sort of look at it in terms of, okay, when we think about net zero, when we think about climate change, when we think about, you know, talking about what we need to do to address it, a lot of, you know, what's said can be interpreted negatively. So it can be seen as disruptive. It can be seen as, you know, you have to change your behavior. It's going to cost you more. We're talking too much about the negatives. You know, is there something in that we need to be talking more about, you know, the potential, the opportunities, and actually how, you know, by, you know, dealing with some of these challenges, by getting ahead of them, we can become more resilient, we can become better, we can become more profitable. And you know, whilst you know, looking at it more in terms of you know how the old saying goes, the sort of carrot and stick, we need more of the carrot, less of the stick, because people don't necessarily respond so well to the stick. And actually, on that, just to finish up on net zero before we move to data centers, when it comes to net zero, I guess there's perhaps one cause of skepticism or annoyance could be the complexity. So, you know, when it comes to regulations, when it comes to requirements on businesses to measure their carbon footprint, and of course the complexity behind that, and how you can get from you measure your footprint and get one result to using one methodology and a completely different result using another. You know, that in itself could be a cause of frustration. But then, of course, everything that goes with achieving a net zero target as well, how you set a net zero target, if you want it to be science-based, what you have to do that credibly, then how you monitor and how you report. And, a lot of what I read about in terms of corporate net zero targets these days is about companies that aren't failing to meet them or have somehow cancelled their net zero target. Are we, again, a bit like Extinction Rebellion, are we making it worse by making it more complex? And actually, do we need to be just making it simpler, not easier, but simpler for businesses to be able to understand it, to measure their impact and work out what they do to reduce it? Shay, what do you think to this one?
Yeah, I think, I completely agree that, I think that, the complexity of the reporting and tracking of progress and also compliance, the complexity of that would definitely contribute to businesses, especially drawing back on making or making certain moves and actions towards reducing their emissions. But I think it has to be said that progress is being made. When it comes to looking at financial accounting and accounting systems, they also went through this sort of transition where there were a multiplicity of different frameworks that were required to achieve compliance. And as time went on, this multiplicity and complexity was reduced, and more uniformity was created. I think the same thing will likely happen to not just net zero reporting systems in itself, but I think sustainability reporting systems as a whole. So definitely the complexity doesn't help, and the multiplicity of different frameworks that needs to be complied with doesn't help. But I think as we move forward, I think those would get better with time. So if there's just a ray of hope that I could offer on that side, I think.
Thanks, Shay. Ebenezer, what's your thoughts here? Are things going to improve? Do you sort of see signs that businesses that are perhaps turned off by just the complexity and the administrative burden, that it might get easier for businesses in the future, particularly as we move from just focusing on the larger businesses who have traditionally been subject to more of these requirements, and encourage more smaller business, or in some cases require more of the smaller businesses to have to measure their footprints and meet net zero targets.
Yeah, thanks, Simon. Yeah, definitely. I think there is there's a lot to be hopeful about. We've got a huge challenge to overcome, but I think, of course, when you have a look at all of the fantastic initiatives that are going on, particularly here in the UK, and also extensively all over the world, but of course focusing on the UK, gives you a ray of hope at least. And I think as we continue to make things simpler for businesses who, frankly, the majority of them just want to do the right thing, the picture will become brighter as we go along. I think there is a lot of jargons that need to be broken down when it comes to sustainability. There's a lot of complexity that needs to be looked at. There's a lot of mystification, frankly, that needs to be demystified, particularly when it comes to regulations and similar other requirements, where businesses are frankly just scratching their heads and trying to figure out what is north from south. I think there's a lot of work to do there. And the great thing is, that's one of the reasons why we have this podcast.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Quite right. You know, we want to, you know, bust the myths and, you know, help each other to, you know, navigate this increasingly complex area. And hopefully, you know, the complexity will subside. You know, I saw, I think, a LinkedIn post recently talking about sustainable babble, kind of, I guess, sort of talking about how much sort of sustainability professionals or, you know, sustainability frameworks, you know, like to create, you know, a whole new vocabulary and just talk lots of, you know, technical language that nobody else understands. So I think maybe there's an opportunity for coming up with a new acronym here for unnecessary sustainability acronyms, USA. What do you reckon? Maybe think of a few more. If anyone listening wants to come up with some acronyms, not that we've got enough, but all a bit of fun, please do feel free to come up with some. So we've talked a bit about, we've talked quite a lot about net zero. We've talked about you know, the reality of climate change and how that's hit us in some of the extreme weather we've been experiencing in Europe and other parts of the world recently. And before we come to a close, it'd be good just to talk about the other story you mentioned, Shay, about data centers. Now, this is quite interesting because it's something which has been given more and more exposure recently, reading more articles about data centers and their huge energy requirement, the huge water requirement. And of course, you know, data is becoming more and more part of our daily lives, you know, whether it be, you know, the internet, of course, which we've all become so reliant on, but, you know, as we know, more so these days, artificial intelligence, platforms like ChatGPT, incredibly useful, and, you know, in many ways can help us accelerate action to tackle challenges like climate change and many other challenges that are out there as well, you know, helping us to get access to a huge amount of information in a very short space of time. But of course, you know, the counter argument to that is that it can consume a huge amount of energy and a huge amount of water, and there'll be other impacts as well, but they are, you know, two of the most important ones. Just to quote from an article I was reading the other day, I think it's in an article from MIT. It says by 2026, the electricity consumption of data centers is expected to approach 1,050 terawatts, which would bump up data centers to equal fifth place on the global list of energy consumers between Japan and Russia. And another article, which I think was in Forbes, said that already AI's projected water usage could hit 6.6 billion cubic meters by 2027. Huge amount of water, huge amount of energy. I mean, is this sustainable? Do we need to be using AI less? Part of me thinks that how can we? So what's the answer? How do we make data centers and AI more sustainable?
If I could go.
Who wants to go first?
it's quite exciting. Ebenezer, go ahead. I'll come up to you.
Yeah, thanks, Shay. Yeah, very, very, very topical question, Simon. I think this will be the most challenging sustainability question, certainly, I think, of the remainder of this century for a large portion of it. But I think it's going to really kick off as we approach the 2030s, because when you think and look at what the government in the UK is talking about alone in terms of how it wants to integrate AI into every aspect of public services, it's going to be a huge, huge undertaking in terms of getting the satisfying the electricity demand, and also, you know, satisfying the demand for water. So for the UK, particularly the energy National Energy System operator sort of estimates that you know, the electricity demand for the UK will be around 22 terawatt hours for AI data centers by 2030, which is huge. I think in order for us to make AI more sustainable, we probably have to ask ourselves whether we need AI in every aspect of public services delivery and in every aspect of our lives, as is being discussed right now. Because, of course, the number of data centers we will need is going to be directly informed by how expansive we want the use of AI to be. Because the more entrenched AI is in our everyday lives, of course, the more data centers you need, because you need the increased capacity. So I think in order for us to make AI more sustainable, we're going to have to find a balance. We're going to have to come to terms with the fact that we're not going to have enough energy or enough water, both for AI data centers and for domestic and commercial use, right? To be able to have that level of you know, AI being embedded in every aspect of public of the delivery of public services. So we have to come to some kind of a compromise. You know, we have to come to the conclusion that there will be some sectors and some places in commerce where we will not be using AI at an elevated level. And we may prioritize other sectors such as health, for example, where AI can have a significant impact, and we want to have it embedded and, you know, in a granular level at an accelerated pace. So I think that's how we make it more sustainable, right? We have to find a balance, and there will be no magic wand to it just because the electricity and water demands are so significant. Of course, as we and this is the final thing I'll say before I hand back over to Shay. As we move on into the remainder of this century, technological advances will mean that the demands around electricity and water will be less and less. But until we get there, we'll need to find that balance.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with everything that you said, Ebenezer. I mean, just to offer some statistics for the audience regarding data centers. You know, I read that there are about 10,000 of them around the world. Many of them are centered in the USA, the UK, and Germany. And you know, big companies, you know, the location of data centers that, you know, big companies like Amazon, Microsoft, Google, the location of many of these data centers are usually industry secrets. You know, but there was a company, I think Baxtel and Data Center Map, they were able to gather a list of about 632 data centers, either in active development or active already and being used for different services. And even at that, you know, that is out of 10,632 data centers, is still, you know, less than 10% of that. So there are way more. And these companies, you know, they plan to expand their activities. Now, the thing with data centers is that they have to be built inland, because low humidity reduces the risk of metal erosion, and also seawater would cause corrosion if used for cooling. So that means that there would be significant need to use non-sea water or fresh water to cool the data centers. Now, you know, they need a lot of water for cooling. In fact, Microsoft said that about 42% of its water comes from areas with water stress. Now, that was in 2023. I mean, I'm sure that might have improved now. While Google said 15% of its own water comes from areas with high water scarcity. And as you're seeing increased temperatures all around the world, you know, it's likely that drought would also increase going forward. So that poses a huge challenge when it comes to the water issue. So, you know, like Ebenezer was saying, reduction could be a key here when it comes to probably, you know, our use of AI and the need for more data centers, and probably data centers will need to be built at a slower pace than not. But tell the big companies that, and I don't think that would go well with them. Now, when it comes to energy, energy in itself, I think there are companies like Nvidia that makes a significant amount of chips that are used in these data centers. Now, Nvidia itself has recognized the huge energy load that is necessary to keep these data centers running. And that is why I think they're also trying to improve the quality and efficiency of these chips. So I think they released a new chip not too long ago called Blackwell. I think Blackwell, you know, contribute, you know, now you know, it is a chip that you know, that causes less energy to be used, so it's more energy efficient than the previous chips that were that were introduced at the beginning of this particular generative AI journey that we've all been on and we've been enjoying, really. So I think, you know, as Ebenezer again, you know, alluded to, you know, as time goes on, improvements will be seen, but I think for energy in itself, again, as technology goes moves forward, there'll probably be a way for us to use seawater and convert that into fresh water that can be used to cool these systems. There are huge challenges that we're looking at going forward. Again, more discussions need to be had, more actions need to be taken, especially by countries and by these big tech companies that set up these huge data centers around the world.
Yeah, no, I mean, certainly, no. A lot of challenges there. I think some signs of some solutions. You know, could all just ask ChatGPT. I'm sure it will come up with the solution for itself. Is the other idea. I think we could talk more about this perhaps on a future podcast. We're just coming up to the hour now, so I think we'll wrap up. So you know, we've talked about, you know, the challenge of a changing climate. It's interesting, isn't it, when, you know, when we have sort of warmer weather here in the UK, which is where we're doing this podcast from, suddenly it comes into our headlines and we're talking about it. I remember last year when we didn't have such a hot summer, it was as if the problem of climate change had gone away. But you know, it's amazing how sort of sometimes you know, the issues are only relevant when we kind of feel them within our own lives. But so we talked about that. We talked about, you know, some of the sort of skepticism around climate change, whether it, you know, humans have an impact, or, you know, whether you know, that some of the conspiracy theories have some truth to them, which I don't think we're saying they are, but you know, what could be the reasons behind them? You know, what's the pushback, or what's the reason for the pushback against net zero? And then we've talked a bit about data centers as well. And of course, conscious of the fact that we are consuming data by recording this podcast. And actually, just, you know, every day when we sort of think about our emails and the files that we generate, you know, do we all, you know, dispose of our junk emails? Did deleted emails get deleted? Just the amount of clutter that there might be within among everyone. We just don't think about it. We just sort of take it for granted that, you know, it's data, it's free, you know, there's not really an environmental cost to us to it, but actually, as we've just heard, there is a significant environmental cost. Perhaps we need to start thinking about decluttering our own data systems and computers, etc. So lots to think about, lots we've covered, and I think a lot we'll be talking about in future podcasts. And I see just before we go, we've got a comment from Kevin saying I find behavioural change is hard to embed in our modern instant society, often easier to adopt the alternative narratives that almost provide an excuse for not walking the hard miles in sustainability. I feel that some rushed into net zero targets, and as the popular concern tide has gone out a little, the costs of offsetting have bitten in. UK politics, unfortunately, an all-time low of confidence in future planning ability enables negative assessments to flourish. It's a tough balance to strike, but we must walk the path in as balanced a way as possible. Thankfully, investor sentiment on sustainability remains strong and is keeping it front and center, well said. Kevin, and then we've got an idea for an acronym from Simba. Simba, good to see you on the podcast. So since you asked, here's another acronym, Net Zero, with a O, transitioning necessity organizing wing, or as I think the acronym is, Not Now. Very, very good, Simba. And thank you for your kind remarks, your kind comments on this first podcast. So I need would appreciate some occasional Southern African linked topics in future episodes. So yeah, noted, Simba. We'll make sure to do that. And hopefully you've enjoyed this first podcast. We'll make it available for download from the SBA website for members to begin with. And then later we'll be making it available more widely on other podcast channels. So I'd like to thank you, Ebenezer. Thank you, Shay, for joining me for this first podcast, and for everyone who's listened in and who will be listening in to our recording. And I wish you all a good day, and we'll be back soon.